The Pain Pod is produced by Bloodstream Media and is intended for informational and educational purposes only, and is made possible thanks to our sponsor, Trimo Pharmaceuticals. Visit resethastudy.com to learn more about their work.
I think that with every sport, there's a certain level of expectation.
There probably would have to be some deprogramming for me to go and seek help.
What are your goals? We've all heard this before, right? I consistently set goals for myself, and most recently I set a goal to write a new play in 1 month. But in order to reach that goal, I had to commit to writing 1 hour every day. To fulfill this meant I had to get up earlier each day, and if you know me at all, this isn't the easiest task. Don't get me wrong, I love mornings, but getting up earlier to do work, well, that isn't exactly my cup of tea. No, I like coffee and snuggling with my fur babies. But I reminded myself that if I started committing to this behavior every day, I would actually be closer to achieving my goals. Motivation. It's a process that initiates and maintains goal-oriented behavior, basically explaining why a person does something. My desire to finish this play in a month initiated and maintained my goal-oriented behavior of getting up earlier to write for an hour each day. But this is where expectations come into play. Pun intended. Although I got up early, wrote every day for an hour, sometimes more, I still wasn't able to reach my goal. I was very close, but still no cigar. Eventually, I did finish the play, but I couldn't help but feeling like I had failed. I soon realized that my expectations, motivations, and actual goals weren't in sync. I had set out to write a play in a month, but why? The thing is, I wanted to write a new play to boost my creativity and get back to exploring that side of my brain, but I got lost in the process. My motivation got skewed and my expectations were all out of whack, for lack of better words. The glory of finishing this thing in a month became greater than the reason I even started. In our lives, we set goals that motivate us and our behaviors. These goal-oriented behaviors can have an effect on our lives in a positive way. Look, I now get up early and write every day. But sometimes, they can have a painful effect on our lives. In this episode, we talk with a former high-level athlete and a military veteran about the environments that encourage and even celebrate pushing through the pain. We also talk about how goals, expectations, motivation, and the glory of it all can have long-lasting effects on a person's pain experience. Hi, I'm Mel Forrest, and you're listening to The Pain Podcast.
There would be days where it would hurt, but I could push through it, which then led to all of my next injuries that today are still chronic, which the list continues.
This is Camille Simmons, now professional photographer. Camille used to be a high-level college athlete who competed in the sport of fencing.
My name is Camille Simmons, and the most chronic pain out of all my chronic pain would be my hip injuries.
In 2016, Camille was part of the Temple University fencing team before medically retiring in 2020. But her fencing and athletics journey started long before college.
I would think that I didn't really have a choice to be an athlete. My mom kind of made my brother and I pick a sport when we were really little. She said, you have to do something. It doesn't matter what the sport is, but you can't stay at home sitting in front of the TV doing nothing. My brother wanted to start fencing because his best friend fenced. And my mom kind of just was like, all right, you're going to go fence with him. It took me a few years to fall in love with the sport. Probably wasn't until around freshman year of high school that I realized this sport could take me places.
As children transition into adolescence, motivation, goals, and expectations change, especially in competitive sports. Engaging in athletics on a higher level can have many positive effects on adolescents and provide opportunities later in life, like college scholarships.
My brother, seeing how successful he was, I didn't really think I could be at his level, but I knew that if I just pushed myself, I could get something out of it.
No matter what they tell you, teenagers are still growing, mentally and physically. But so are the expectations in competitive sports, which means there's a higher rate of injury.
I started getting a lot of back pain around like 16, 17, which everyone just assumed it was because I was a young adolescent girl. A lot of us get back pains because we're growing and we're becoming women.
Children and teens are expected to incur some injury in their lives. But as parent and pain advocate Donna Sullivan shared in episode 2, there's a common misconception that children and teens are resilient and bounce back easily from injury or pain. This isn't always true.
It wasn't really addressed very well. This was already like 3 years of some back issues that my mom realized, okay, it's not really normal to have back pain like this. This isn't an average complaint. I went to the doctor and they did an MRI and saw that I had
Spondylolysis occurs when a problem in the spine causes a small crack or fracture between two vertebrae. Spondylolysis causes back pain, but is treatable, usually without surgery. And treatments, such as medication and physical therapy, are most successful when started early.
There was a slight injury to my back, and if you catch it in time, it's fixable. You just do PT. I didn't fix it right away, so it took a little bit longer. There would be days where it would hurt, but I could push through it, which then led on to all of my next injuries that today are still chronic, which the list continues. Then I went to college, and I'm not exactly sure how this happened, but I ended up injuring my wrist. It was just a lot of overworking it, because I went from fencing in high school to then going into a college program where you have mandatory weightlifting, you have practice. And I came from a very hardcore fencing club. We proudly say that we're the best club in America, which we will believe is true until the end of the day. But like, we are one of the top ranked clubs. So we have a very rigorous program. But adding that weightlifting, definitely, I wasn't used to it. My wrist started hurting. We got an MRI. I tore my TFCC. And in that diagnosis, they realized my ulna bone, which is the outside wrist bone, is significantly shorter on both arms, which means I'm predisposed to wrist injuries.
Having a TFCC, or triangular fibrocartilage complex tear, is not good for anyone, but especially not good for someone who fences.
I got diagnosed around like December with a potential TFCC tear. So I scheduled the surgery at the end of the season, so like March. And through this time, I remember like very distinctly, I went to the athletic trainer and I said, hey, my hip has been hurting really badly. It feels like I did a crazy hip workout, but I haven't. I didn't want to complain about it too much.
In high-level athletics, a person is expected to push through the pain. So reaching out when they are in pain might be uncomfortable. One might fear being judged, criticized, or viewed as weak and given less opportunity on the team. And these fears and expectations are what prevent many athletes from coming forward about pain.
That pain persisted until sophomore year, where I just finally said, it really hurts. Can we go to the doctor? Did MRI? Labral tear.
Camille had a labral tear on her left hip. A hip labral tear is an injury to the labrum, which is the soft tissue that covers the socket of the hip. This tear can be caused by injury, structural problems, or degenerative issues. Symptoms include pain in the hip or stiffness. A hip labral tear can be treated non-surgically, but severe cases need surgery.
Junior year, I was coming back from that surgery and just had a lot of pain on the right side.
If a person has a labral tear in one hip, it's not uncommon to develop a tear in the other side. Camille was now experiencing pain in the right hip. But there was a pushback when it came to her access to care through the NCAA.
There's a very like strict way you go through things. I think that the rules that the NCAA puts in place for athletes to get proper treatment when it comes to MRIs and stuff, these rules are so strict. I had a different athletic trainer every year, and every athletic trainer that we had was really good and supportive. And they always said, I wish that we could just go get an MRI, but instead you have to go see the team doc, and the team doc is only here 2 days a week, and you have class at this time, and you have practice. It's going to be a few weeks till you see him. And I think that the NCAA side was not the best. A lot of people have the same complaint. If you're not football or basketball, there's a lot of hoops that you have to jump through in order to just get a simple scan. But once I got that scan and once I got that diagnosis, it was pretty quick and helpful. I think it's just hard because the NCAA is a business, and I don't want to speak ill about them because I love my experience of being an athlete, and I do think that there's so much support for once you do get injured, but it is a business.
Sometimes the business and protocol of things doesn't necessarily have the athlete's health as top priority. As her pain began to add up, it became harder for Camille to push through. The love of fencing was still there, but due to the expectations to perform at a certain level and the pain she was experiencing, Camille's motivation and goals began to shift.
Senior year, I came back in still saying I have a lot of pain, and I had to have a lot of conversations like with my family and my coaches at home to like talk about like what is the best route. And I sat down with the coach at Temple after discussing this with my family, basically saying, I don't know if I'm going to be able to make it through the season because I'm in so much pain. And it's not just pain while fencing. It's pain walking, sitting, like...
Chronic. The pain became chronic.
I competed in two tournaments, and I kind of, like, hinted to my family, like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to fence much longer. So my brother actually flew out to watch me fence. And then in that day, I could tell by the end of the day, that was my last day fencing. I think that with every sport, there's a certain level of expectation. With fencing, the expectation is you're going to be covered in bruises and you might twist your ankle every now and then. We're not known to be a very high risk, high injury sport. Through recent years and like studies and just people I know, injuries are becoming like more and more common, especially labral tears, ACL tears. And I think it's just like the expectation through time in different sports changes. So like fencing used to be super easy. Now I think everyone's just going crazy and like training all the time. So the expectation of skill level plus physicality and then injury level is going higher.
Since retiring from fencing, Camille has had surgery on her right hip for a labral tear and continues her recovery. She is now a professional photographer and recognizes that pushing through her pain and previous injuries now contributes to the daily pain she experiences outside of sports.
People who live in chronic pain, especially like athletes, speak up. Because when I was going through everything I was going through, there was really no one that was outspoken about it. A lot of years of putting hard toll on my body. But it's definitely not like an uncommon story. It's just not the one that you publicize when you say like sports.
Camille's story is not an uncommon one, but as she suggested, the physical toll of being a high-level collegiate athlete is not something we hear much about. Next, we change gears to hear from military veteran Matt Ulrich about his journey with chronic pain and what it means to push through for the greater good. But first, a brief word about our sponsor.
My name is Patrick James Lynch, and I have severe hemophilia A. As someone living with hemophilia and arthritis in my joints, I know firsthand how difficult and debilitating chronic pain can be. I also know the challenges that come with trying to find relief, which is why I'm excited to share with you the RESET HA study from Tremo. Tremo was founded with the goal of developing and delivering non-opioid pain therapies for people living with pain. Tremo's RESET HA study is a clinical research study for people who experience joint pain due to hemophilia. The study is evaluating an oral non-opioid investigational drug designed to be taken once a day to see if it may potentially help relieve joint pain and improve physical function in people with hemophilic arthropathy, or HA. You may be eligible to participate in this clinical research study if you are between the ages of 12 and 75, have been diagnosed with hemophilia A or B, have chronic pain in one or more joints, and do not take opioid medication more than 4 days a week. If you are interested in learning more about the RESET HA study, visit resethastudy.com. That's RESETHASTUDY.com to find a study location near you. Reset the way you manage your pain. Visit resethastudy.com today.
My name is Matt Ulbrich, and I was in the military from 2002 to 2007 as an infantry soldier. So it was a very busy time to be there, to be in the military.
This is Matt Ulbrich, who served in Iraq and Afghanistan with the United States Army and experiences chronic pain today.
I do experience chronic pain from my time in the military. Back, knee, hip, your standard stuff from just having to carry heavy loads, do lots of things.
Matt grew up in Dallas, Texas. He talks about his motivation and reasons for joining the U.S. Army.
I joined right after September the 11th. I was 20 at the time. I've been arrested a bunch and was in college, just really realized I need something to change. September the 11th happened, and I didn't want to be in a perpetual cycle of just feeling like a loser, and that hero complex hit me. I mean, it was as if I was still critical of our country and our actions, but it was like my brain was suddenly red, white, and blue, and I was just stuck on joining the military.
The choices we make can affect the trajectory of our lives. That day, Matt made a choice to join the U.S. Army. An institution that carries a certain level of expectations. Loyalty, duty, respect, selfless service, honor, integrity, and personal courage. Matt expands on these and the physical expectations that would later contribute to his pain experience.
So you already know that your physical fitness level needs to be high or high enough to a certain degree. They do it pretty early on in basic training, but they also have thresholds. You need to fall within a certain range of physical fitness. They're checking your mobility, your BMI, all that stuff. So they're setting the tone to let you know, like, hey, you're meant to be at a certain operational level. So from there, you could just naturally assume, probably pay for some of this a little bit later. It was the senior officials and the folks that were teaching me and guiding me or were in charge of me, not just in basic training, but beyond that, that continued to talk about these specific problems. And it blows my mind to think that right now I'm 40 and I had leaders who looked like they were in their 50s and they were like 35 telling me this is just going to get worse for you.
The military often requires a person to mentally and physically rebuild themselves. Even though Matt had the knowledge that his body was going to be tested and he could potentially experience chronic pain in life beyond the military, being a productive member of his unit was the end goal. Pushing through the pain to be at peak operational level is key, but Matt expands on the reality of combat and what it means to address and acknowledge personal pain thresholds in high-stakes situations.
I think movies actually portray this fairly well. If someone gets hurt, they are now a liability. Combat and effectiveness, it's going to take about three other people to handle that one person. So from there, we do need to hear honestly from soldiers what their pain thresholds are and understand that unless you've lost life, limb, or eyesight, you need to get moving. Because you're a liability to everybody else. Now, moving could be like, okay, I'll cover you and get you back to the vehicle. But there is a part of it that you need to have a stiff upper lip and you need to toughen up. I'm sure that there's some old world thinking that by treating us like that makes it better for combat. also in the infantry, you have a higher washout point. If you push that threshold really high, so you can find out who your weak and who your strong ones are. And for some people, they feel that's a valid way to assess folks. And when I was in the military, I probably did it as well and didn't quite realize it.
As we touched upon earlier in this episode, there's an expectation to push through the pain, especially within the military. Pain can sometimes equate to weakness, and this can definitely have an effect on a person's experience of pain.
I've seen some major stuff happen, and dudes not know it until much later, and that is product of the environment. I had a friend once ask me, how can you just notice that you just didn't get hurt? Well, have you ever just gone for a walk in the woods or something? Or did you ever play sports and just suddenly after the game or after the end of your walk, or you get home or you're in the shower and you're like, why does that hurt so bad?
Why does that hurt so bad? Institutional, systematic, environmental, and cultural factors, just to name a few, can affect when and how we perceive and experience pain. They also have an effect on our access to care.
Every single company has their own medical block of medic folks. Then you also have a headquarters company that deals with all of those other companies, and then they even have more medical folks. Then on base, you have great hospitals, great facilities, at least the base that I was at, Fort Wainwright, Alaska. I remember having wisdom teeth problems. I went in, they were like, oh, we'll just take them all out, because I wasn't deployed at the time. You're not going to work this Tuesday. Make sure you have somebody pick you up. You'll get an entire week off. It's a pretty good system that's set up. So if you need your teeth fixed, if you need glasses, if you come in with pre-existing conditions that would still deem you fit for the military physically and mentally, but it needs to be addressed, they will take care of it.
A part of being at top operational level means addressing a person's physical and mental needs. So it's no wonder that the care and treatment for pain and injuries while enlisted in the military is so good. But after years of pushing oneself to extremes, physically, mentally, and emotionally, what happens? How does a soldier transition to civilian life, and what does their access to care look like?
There probably would have to be some deprogramming for me to go and seek help. We have to try to find care. We have to understand what our pain is and try to manage it moving forward.
Coming back to civilian life can be jolting. For years, a soldier will dedicate themselves to rebuilding and pushing their minds and bodies to the limit, acting for the greater good and mission at hand, all while being looked after by an institution that needs them to be at top operational level. Civilian life is different. There's a focus that's now on oneself rather than the greater good or your unit. And there's no institution dictating what you must do or navigating your access to care. You no longer need to be at top operational level, which can be difficult to digest or deprogram. Matt discusses his access to care and pain management outside of the U.S. Army.
After I got out of the military, I'm glad that I had VA care there for me and available.
VA is the Veterans Healthcare Administration, which is a form of healthcare provided to military veterans to cover regular checkups with primary care providers and appointments with specialists. According to the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, there are roughly 1,293 healthcare facilities offered to over 9 million veterans enrolled in the VA healthcare program.
Large cities have great VA facilities. It's just a great rule of thumb. The problem that I'd found early on with the VA is that you really kind of have to set yourself up first. There's not a perfect seamless transition between your military records going from one thing to the other. I was also of the generation when they were digitizing records. When I first showed up to the VA, I had to give them so much more stuff that they couldn't find because either hadn't been digitized yet or was lost. Since then, I've had a couple instances where the VA were like, oh, we haven't seen you in a while. I was like, you saw me last week. What are you talking about? There are some records discrepancies and things like that to the degree that I feel like that may not exist within private care. Even though I have access to VA care, it's not always there for me. Even though I do have Veterans Choice, I still have to wait in line just like anybody else. The medical system is still aggressively confusing to try to navigate. It's accessible, but it's difficult to navigate.
When you're enlisted in the Army, there's a level of expectation when it comes to pain, but there's also a level of care that's provided. When a soldier returns to civilian life, they carry things over with them, and sometimes that includes chronic pain. And although they are no longer in high-stakes situations, deprogramming and returning to everyday life can be just as stressful, and the systems set up to support our veterans are far from ideal.
I used to just try to be stubborn and just think, well, my pain is not as rough as someone else's. So it doesn't matter whether my pain was from something that happened to me in Iraq or someone who was in a bad accident and it wasn't their fault. I just feel it's not productive to the conversation to talk about how I got there. It's more that now that I'm there now, like, why is the system a little bit difficult and broken and busted for both veterans and also for individuals?
So what are your goals? We've all heard this before, and the truth is, goals change. Lives shift. Motivations, desires, and expectations do an about-face. And sometimes, the choices we make and the dreams we chase at different points of our lives can have long-lasting effects on the way we experience pain. And while reflecting on choices and the reasons why we may be in pain is important, it's not the ultimate goal. Expectations from ourselves, institutions, and society are major factors. And by reframing them, creating a space to talk openly about chronic pain and providing adequate, equitable access to care for those not just in athletics and the military, but everyone, should be the ultimate goal. Because no one should be expected to spend their life pushing through the pain.
Bias can really get in the way of a lot of different things. And that has actually been my own personal experience.
We discuss how racial bias can affect the pain experience next time on the Pain Podcast. The Pain Podcast is written and hosted by me, Mel Forrest, produced by Greg Holtzman, edited by Colby Crow, artwork by Ryan Gielen and Christina Newhard, post-production support from Joshua Sterling Bragg, Rob Bradford, Allison Stoney, and Avra Friedman, and executive produced by Patrick James Lynch. The Pain Pod is produced by Bloodstream Media and presented by Tremo Pharmaceuticals. Tremo's Reset HA study is a clinical research study for people who experience joint pain due to hemophilia. And you can learn more about it by visiting resethastudy.com. And as always, if you like this episode, make sure to subscribe, rate, and share the Pain Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Mel Forrest, and we'll be back next time with episode 6 of the Pain Pod.